Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Big Jim Show is sponsored by Maul & Brawl. Maul & Brawl is the best men's skin and beard care products on the market right now. Maybe. How do I know? Because it's mine. 100% owned by me. Tried and tested by me. Whether you've been mauling in the office or brawling in your bed, Maul & Brawl is for you. We've got a shower gel which is scented dark honey and tobacco. The moisturiser has a scent of ivory musk, and the beard oil will make your beard feel smooth and silky and smelling like whiskey. It comes in three packages. The Simple Man, which is the shower gel. The Modern Man, which is the shower gel and the moisturiser. Or the Caveman, which is the shower gel, moisturiser and beard oil. To order, go to maulandbrawl.com and type in the code BIGJIM10 for 10% off. Maul & Brawl, for men that maul.
Big Jim is wearing his heels.
There are ways to ask questions, and there are ways to talk and present to people. And if you use Formula One as an example, 20 drivers, I'd probably ask half of them exactly the same question in a different way, because I know how their minds operate and know what buttons I need to press. The great thing is that when you love what you do, it doesn't really feel like work. I've never woken up on a morning and thought, do you know what, I want to be the best female to ask a question today. I want to be the best female to present a programme today, because I would only be seeing 50% of the bigger picture. I want to be the best person. It was great fun, and I did share a podium with Michael Schumacher, albeit I was wearing leather chaps and a Stetson at the time, so, you know, it was a bit random.
On this episode, I'm joined by one of the best in the business. It's the wonderful, the lovely Lee McKenzie.
God, you must be raking it in if you're on the AG1s.
No, I've been on AG1, Athletic Greens, big shout out, for years.
Well, I'm an investor in 4 or 5.
Are you?
Yeah, I am. So I'm like staying true to your Saracens friends.
That's a big shout out.
Unlike you.
Well, no.
Who's on the AG1?
I'm on AG1. I swear by it. This is the thing, when you're travelling on the road.
Yeah.
Everything.
Oh, you have to take everything.
Yeah.
My bag is normally full of things that will keep me alive for the next month.
Yeah.
Actually, that Rehydrate that 4 or 5 have brought out is a game changer. And I gave it to one of my colleagues during the Grand Prix who was so hungover. And within about 15 minutes, they were like, zing.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
What's in it?
I don't know.
What
I haven't
is in
asked
it?
George and Dom. I'm not sure if they...
I'm a big advocate of that kind of stuff. The CBD, I take that. I do. 4 or 5. There's a couple of other lads.
Pure Sport and stuff.
Pure Sport. Look at us just giving people... Oh, the millions are going to be like, oh, who are these? Know. Who do you think you are?
Yeah. But then as someone did say to me, a supplement is meant to be that. It's meant to supplement good things in your life. You can't just live on a supplement.
Well, big shout out to Athletic Greens, AG1.
And 4 or 5. That.
And 4 or 5, George Cruz. He's not asked me, he sent me stuff. I said, well, actually, he didn't send me stuff. I was like, you're sending everyone else stuff, and you're not sending me stuff. And my back is wrecked from doing all George Cruz's training. And then he played the big games. No, they're good, though. They're good lads. Him and Dom Day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Have we even started? I don't know what's going on.
We'll get into it. It's great to have you in the studio. We've been talking about it for a while, haven't we?
It's been a while.
It has, and then we were together last week at the World Rugby Conference Award in Dublin.
We were.
Do you enjoy it?
I loved it. I was hosting, and we had to have lots of meaningful conversations. And then along came something called Boom Time, where we're all given a stick that we just had to like hit our hands with and make a musical note for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I thought that was incredible.
Some of the stuff I struggled with because I'm not used to it. So Boomtown, I did enjoy
Boom Time.
Boom Time. Sorry, I was engaged. Boom Time. Boom, 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 boom. I want to have a dun, dun, dun.
It's a cup of tea.
Yeah, I want to have a cup of tea. So we did. It was a team building exercise, and then we did. I told you about it. This building bridges out of chopsticks, which I refused to do.
Yeah.
And there was a load of things that come from the World Rugby Conference. So for the listeners who don't know, so Lee McKenzie was there as one of the greatest hosts ever. So when you were there, I was like, wow, they mean business. Like, this is a real thing. And it was a team building, get to know each other. And again, people will know that I've got a new role at World Rugby as creative director, whatever that means. But this is all new to me, like the corporate environment.
Yeah.
And I saw you with that. I was like, oh, okay, it's the real deal.
Game on.
And game on. That was it. That's one of the taglines. And there was different speakers that came up, and it was like part of the team building stuff. But also they were revealing within the whole organization the insights. And I've never done insights before, but it's basically you've got to do an online thing, like a questionnaire, and then it comes out like what you are, whether or not like the colour of red of angry men, or yellow inspiring and lovely, blue boring as hell and analytical, green like undecisive and just there. I'm being harsh there, but it was to get to know everyone.
Yeah,
and it was quite insightful.
Yeah, I didn't get to do that bit. I think that must have been the Thursday. I was there the Tuesday, Wednesday. But it's interesting. I think people who come from a team sport background treat these things very differently. I didn't ever do team sports really at school, or if I did, it was like to a very basic level. Any sports I did were individual. You could say that presenters are quite selfish people, journalists are quite selfish people. So everything I do is quite individual. So it kind of amazes me when I look around and or I go to these things and listen, you know, the importance of team and working together and things, because it, you know, it's a little alien to me. Whereas, you know, in conversations I've had with former players or all the rest of it, I'll say, but what happens if you really don't like someone who's in your team? And they're like, well, you just have to get on with it. And I'm like, well, maybe that's a healthier approach as opposed to harbouring a grudge for the rest of your life. But it's really, it's an interesting dynamic for me going to these sorts of things and seeing it. I always think you can learn something about what you like or possibly what you don't like. But yeah, it was a good couple of days.
Yeah, it was. The thing on that insights thing, and I'm a bit of an outlier. Like, I just am. Like, I do love being in a team. Like, I need that. I yearn for it. But I also like stepping out and doing my own thing. Like, I'm a little bit rogue, and I like that, as in I'm unapologetic about that. But then doing these insights and stuff, a lot of the businesses do it, don't they? So you get to know your colleagues. Like, everyone has a voice, everyone has feelings, which we all know. But that was the interesting thing. I'm just going to get mine up here, actually, because I'm going to profile
your results.
Profile you. Not all of them. Not all of them, but I took a screenshot of it somewhere.
See, I did one of these things once, and the guy, I actually just had to sort of profile myself. And the psychologist who works with a lot of different sports governing bodies said that he was really shocked how not comfortable, but how understanding I was about me as a person, good and bad. You know, I sort of sit here, I think I pretty much know my flaws. Are they flaws? Some people would definitely say yes. I don't know. It's just part of me and I can change them. But I'm pretty aware of who I am.
All right.
It doesn't mean to say it's good, but, you know, I think that's half of the thing, isn't it? Knowing yourself.
Well, let's find out. So I've got the way my mind works, I took a picture of like the negative ones of your colours. So
my colours? Well, no, yours.
You can say, yeah, everyone's.
You've not profiled me, have you?
No, you can. I'm going to try and guess. But I say this because me and the wife had an argument the other night, and the bad colours of me came out and the bad colours of her came out. And I sent her this kind of, I call it a pie chart. It's not a pie chart, is it? It's like a circle wheel or whatever it is. And I said that was the red energy of me coming out against your green. Do you want to hear the green? So I called her green on bad. So this is like, so there are positives. I don't know which ones they are. I've just gone straight for the negative ones. But if you're a green, you're docile. I called my wife a green. Docile, bland, plodding, reliant, and stubborn. I meant the stubborn part, but I had to read out the docile.
I just think locks are being changed whilst you're sitting here.
I know. And then I said, I brought out my yellow, which was excitable, frantic, indiscreet, flamboyant, and hasty. But she said, well, it's not. She said, because you were red, which was aggressive, controlling, driving, overbearing, and intolerant. Intolerant.
Yeah.
That was me. And then you've got blue, which is, I'm not a blue fan. Stuffy, indecisive, suspicious, cold, and reserved. And I said that was weird. And she said, well, you can't say that that's
I might have a couple
weird.
Of bits from blue. I might be cold.
Okay.
Cold towards people sometimes.
So the blue one is also like very analytical.
Maybe.
Doesn't speak unless there's something that really needs to be said.
Oh, no.
No, no.
I shall find out over the next hour.
We might have a little bit of a blue. But we learned that from the World Rugby Conference.
Okay.
So with all these sports that you're in, and rugby's in a weird place, so when you went there, and this isn't me selling World Rugby, this isn't me talking up because I'm involved, like I've genuinely taken that role. I wasn't going to take the role because I didn't understand the direction of rugby. I was actually thinking, do I potentially move away from rugby? And then I met with my boss, James Rothwell, and he sold me the dream. Yeah. And spoke to me about some of the people that were involved in this vision. You got to see a snapshot of that. I've taken the role, which kind of says that I've not just taken it because it's a job. I didn't need to take it. I wanted to.
Yeah.
And I've seen the blueprint of how the game moves forward. And yes, there's other stuff that needs to be done. I understand that. But as in the headline stuff, the direction of the game was and is so exciting.
Yeah.
I wish I could tell people, but there is stuff in the works and what you can say. Now I'm in a corporate environment. But when you were there, could you see bits where you were like, yeah, I get it. I can see the direction of travel and rugby has got the ability to get itself in a really good place again?
I think when you're presenting sport or sitting at home watching sport, you do not consider the fact that there are hundreds of people with a plan for the next 10 years, particularly if you look at what's happened in rugby domestically in the UK over the last, 12 months. You could be, quite within your rights to think, well, what on earth are rugby doing? Is there a 12-month plan? Is there a 12-year plan? So for me, it was very heartening to see the understanding that there is. I think what's also really important is that the fact that if that Rugby World Cup hadn't happened in 2019, just before the pandemic hit, I think rugby would be in a much, much more difficult place globally. And that sort of gives you goosebumps thinking about it. I mean, the Olympics, Paralympics were delayed. I did them in 2021. I was meant to do the British and Irish Lions tour. I couldn't get to South Africa. I did it from Llanelli, which isn't quite what I signed up for, but it was still fun. I think that rugby is in a really great place, but there's so much expansion that they can still have. And I think that's the real positive thing about it, that it's such a, I think it's a wonderful sport. It's the first sport I ever actually watched as a kid. My father used to take me to rugby matches all over. And, I want it to be bigger and better and more inclusive in terms of the countries, like, going to the States and things is hugely important. Trying to involve other countries, trying to lift tier two. Otherwise, there's not going to be any growth, any more development, and there needs to be.
When they say inclusivity, you've just nailed it there. That's when we talk about diversity, inclusivity in rugby, like you've nailed it there. The other countries, like the tier two countries, which have the keys to the kingdom, because some of them are the greatest rugby players on earth. We've spoken about it loads on the rugby pod, but you only have to look. And I'm not saying that South Africa are a tier two nation, they're not, but with everything that goes with that and then where they come from, different parts of Africa as well, like a lot of from Zimbabwe, from Namibia as well, but more so Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, Georgia now as well. Like that's what I think you mean, that's what I mean when we talk about inclusivity and growing the game. It's not necessarily, oh, we need to do X, Y and Z and start ticking boxes.
I don't think these countries, should be plundered. I understand why players go off and play elsewhere. That's absolutely fine. I you could see it from the Rugby World Cup. You saw the squads that were announced last week. Now that the players are returning to play for their nations, and you're like, wow, these are like becoming super sides. People talked about, oh, there's only a few teams and, that could win this World Cup and all the rest of it. I think there's going to be a few shocks because all these you know, guys going back, you know, Charles Pietau and all these big names going back. You're like, wow, we've created some super sides here just by changing the rules. And hopefully that, because it doesn't matter what sport you're in, it doesn't matter where you're from, you've got to have people to look up to. And if you're coming from a Pacific island, you want to look up to people who are representing your island, not who are representing England or New Zealand or even Scotland or something like that. I understand why it's happened, but how great would it be to get back to the stages where, you know, Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, you know, they are really properly taking the world on.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Like the World Cup is going to be unbelievable.
Yeah, I cannot
in
wait.
France. Like genuinely, because we are sat in the studio in London and the Premiership is not even on its knees, it's on its back at the minute. And I just put a tweet. I'm not great on Twitter. That's why I love doing podcasts. I'm just not great at, like, well, you know, because I send you voice notes. I'm not great at texting or typing. And yeah. I can't contextualise, but I put a tweet out about, like, the World Cup, how good it's going to be, having watched the top 14 final.
Yeah, that was mega.
I mean, France is just a crazy rugby country anyway, and it's a thriving market. From all points, participation, the commercial TV deals, salary of players, which I'm big for and people hate me keep banding on about it. But France, talking about Japan, the investment that they've got, yes, it's money coming from big businesses. And there are pockets of growth where I see the game is in a great place. And I think the World Cup in France will showcase that. And I am one for being positive about it. I understand the problems and the issues rugby's had. But all sports have issues and problems, but also see the positives. And I think the World Cup in France will paper over, if that's the right term to use, the cracks that are in the game. But hopefully, like, propel us forward. It's the third biggest. I'm going to say it's the third. It might be the fourth, but the third biggest showcase.
Yeah, they said the third.
They said the third, you know, at the World Rugby Conference. But like, having been there, and you think about the Football World Cup, how big that is, the Olympics that you've been a part of as well, it's the third biggest.
Yeah.
Like, that's rugby, that's my sport.
Yeah.
That's a sport that you're involved in as well. So rugby's not dying.
No, you just have to look at the Six Nations that we had this year for that as well. I think that was, okay, there was a lot of politics going on during it, particularly in Wales, but yeah, I thought it was fantastic to see Italy raise their game. That's what you want. There shouldn't be a match that you go into it almost knowing the outcome before it started. And I think it was a bit of a tonic, you know, for all the other dramas that had been going on in the background.
Positivity. I weren't going to talk too much about rugby with you. Well, I have been listening to your book for the last few days.
Oh, wow. Thank
I have.
You.
I was very happy, actually. Big shout. Inside F1.
Are you sick of the sound F1? Of my voice? Because I actually narrate the audio book.
Yes, I like that.
Okay.
And I did ask you, because I'm not great at reading either, so audio book. And I was like, I'm only going to listen to it if you're narrating it. Like Matthew McConaughey does his green lights, or rad, or rad. Like, as in, I need the authenticity. with it, and there was a few things. I haven't listened to it all.
Okay.
9 hours or 8 hours and a bit. But I was very happy because the introduction, the foreword is by
David Coulthard.
I was going to say Coulthard, but
everyone calls him David Coulthard. He just replies to anything.
Okay. David Coulthard said it.
Coulthard, yeah.
But then I was very happy because my favourite driver was up first, Michael Schumacher, the great Michael Schumacher. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about Lewis Hamilton, which we can get onto. He was second.
Yeah.
So I was like, do I skip through to the end where Jenson Button's the last one? I was like, no, I'm going to listen to these two properly. And then I segued into a few of the others.
Okay.
But it seems from listening to that book, sounds weird to say listening to a book.
Yeah.
That is it fair to say that Formula One is your favourite sport, the one that you've grown up with? I mean, because you're across so many. Rugby, we've just touched on. Formula One. Tennis, Olympics, like the biggest sports, but I get the sense that Formula One is the one.
Formula One is all-encompassing just because it has taken up so much of my life, which wasn't really a conscious choice. It's just the way it worked out. You know, now there's 23 races a year. You don't do all the races. Nobody in their right mind, apart from the drivers, do all the races, but then they have a bit of financial gain and they're flying in their own planes. So we split the presentation. You know, when I first got into it, there were maybe 18 races a year or something, and it would take up half, over half, three quarters of the year. Now it's almost wall to wall. So by default, it becomes your life. And I do absolutely love it. But I wouldn't say it was there above rugby or above doing Wimbledon. I think when you break it down, there'll be some races that you don't enjoy. There'll be some races that you absolutely love. A little bit like, you know, I love the Six Nations and I love Wimbledon. So you can actually like, you know, sections of rugby or sections of tennis, as it were. And there are some races which are fantastic and I love the places that we go to. And there are others where you're a bit like, do I really want to go to that one? Mm. But it's everything. It's entertainment. It's politics. It's, you know, some of the highest class sport. There's an element of danger. There's everything really rolled into Formula One. But that people are starting to see now because of all the behind-the-scenes programmes that go on. But I've been part of it since a very early age. I was the annoying kid that turned up at so many different sports events, which was fantastic because I was exposed to so much. And then I was like, people can get paid to do this? Sign me up.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I kind of was working in sport from the age of 15 onwards. And I did news as well. I did the Lockerbie trial and you know, general elections and things too. But there's just something about sport that I find really engaging.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
So in the, is it the foreword?
The foreword.
At the start?
Yes.
The introduction. I was going to call it. You spoke about something quite powerful and it was being at the race, the Ayrton Senna. Passed.
My father was there. I was watching it on TV.
Oh, you were watching. Yeah, so your father was there. So you got, I mean, that was one of the first things I imagine that you saw.
So I used to watch Formula One because I couldn't quite understand where my dad went every weekend. I was like, this is really weird.
He's on the jolly.
Yeah, he's on the jolly. So that's why I started watching sport, because it was a sort of understanding as, you know, as to where your family vanished off to. And I was watching that race. My father was there. He ended up going to Ayrton's funeral in Brazil. And that was that whole weekend, actually. We focus on the Sunday. But the Friday, there was a massive accident for Rubens Barrichello. The Saturday, there was a massive accident which resulted in the death of Roland Ratzenberger. And then the Sunday, there was the accident. This is all at the same racetrack, Imola, that claimed the life of Ayrton Senna. So as a weekend for a young girl watching sport and me thinking that sport was a great fun place that you go to lose yourself or just have a couple of hours watching something, suddenly took quite a nasty turn, because you realise that some sports are not just dangerous, but they can claim lives. And that one weekend was, I suddenly realised the enormity of what can happen, you know, in Formula One terms.
Yeah, it was, I mean, crazy. And you saw the scene. Yeah. And I recently used to watch Formula One. I do watch a little bit of it now. Yeah. Big shout out to Drive to Survive. They got me back into it, like millions of others in America as well. Yeah. Danny Ricciardo, never heard of him before. Did I call him Danny?
You can call him Danny.
Can I call him Danny?
He would like you to call him Danny. He'd be fine. Yeah. He's a good guy.
Daniel Ricciardo.
Danny Rick.
So, yeah, that's when you know. That actually, so I was a Formula One fan.
Yeah.
So growing up, watching Schumacher, Ferrari, all the icon, the easy stuff to watch, like watching Monaco, had the Formula One game as well, which I absolutely loved, like just rinsing people on the outside in Monaco. And
Because you can't overtake that, can you? It's a hard place to overtake in Monaco. Not in the game, it's not. You just fly down the inside, rip your wheels off. So I used to love Formula One and then just didn't have the time to watch it. And then now I've got back into it. Like a really interesting sport because of the... It's, and this is what drives the Survivor show. It's the glitz, the glamour, the money, the travel.
Yeah.
It is, I mean, it's quite an unbelievable setup when you think about it. And you, like you being involved in that, and this is a two-pronged question. So with the glitz and the glamour, everything that goes with it, I know there's a lot of travel. And we can get onto that, like how you manage that. But also being a woman in that environment, because from what I see, it's all men. Where are there many other women involved?
Yeah, there are. When I first started, my first full season in F1 was 2009. But I'd done all the support races just like the drivers do. You know, very few people turn up in F1. You've got to start and work your way up, which is what I did. And going back to like, say, 2005, there weren't that many. But there are always more. You know, at the beginning, I suppose, there were grid girls and catering girls and a few journalists. And now there are a lot more journalists. There's a lot more female presence. There are engineers, you know, there are strategists sitting on the pit wall, which I think is really important. People spend their life asking me about, you know, when will there be the next female Formula One driver? And I work with some different sort of projects and commissions. And I don't want to just focus on the next female driver. I want to focus on engineers and strategists, which is a bit ironic because these are, you know, your STEM subjects, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, basically four subjects that I wasn't allowed near at school because I wasn't remotely bright enough. But I think it's really empowering and important to show to young girls that they can sit on a pit wall and they can determine race strategy. And some of the, you know, the great females or the great strategists out there are female, but you maybe don't get to see that as much. So it's not like I'm the only female wandering around. You do sometimes get on a plane because quite often we charter flights and sometimes you get on it and you'll look around and you'll be like, yeah, all I see is massive men. But I don't even really notice it because it's my work. And
you've been in it all your life as well.
Yeah, you just sort of like get on with it.
So the women can race. Can they? If there was a woman that came through that was good enough, she'd be able to race.
100%.
And has that happened before? Yeah, excuse my ignorance.
There have been female Formula One drivers in the past. You know, not for a very long time. We're getting on 50 years now. But I presented for the last few years a all-female racing series, which I wasn't sure about when it first started off because, you know, my background would be equestrian or I've done some co-driving in the World Rally Championship as well. But I couldn't quite understand why women needed their own series. So I went out to Spain and I spoke to all the girls and some of them were very talented and I knew that. I just didn't understand why they hadn't got on. They just said there was absolutely no sponsorship or opportunity available for them. So I thought, well, they would know more than I do. I'd formed the wrong opinion, so I started to present it. And that has been a springboard for them to go. So Jamie Chadwick won the championship for the last 3 years. She's now racing in America. And there are some really, really talented young girls coming through, sort of 18, 19. But as I say, you don't just start in Formula One. So it's going to take time for the person to get to Formula One standards. And also, I think it's really worth saying as well, you don't want someone there just for tokenism because the spotlight is going to be so hard on whoever that female driver is. She can't be average. And there have been a few guys over the years who have been on the grid that it's always discussed, you know, should they have been there? Have they bought their place there? That has happened, but this poor girl, whoever it's going to be, this blessed girl, is going to have to be absolutely at the peak and as tough as she can be because every single thing she does is going to be scrutinised. But she needs to be there on merit. That's the most important thing for me. There can be no tokenism. She needs to be there on merit. Otherwise, it undoes all the efforts that have been made for the past few years.
Can you see it happening?
I can see it happening. But I can't see it happening in the next 3, 4, or 5 years.
Because the amount of science and investment to look into that space, I mean, it's obvious, right? In rugby, a woman can't play in the men's game because of the contact element. But from a racing point of view, have they looked into anything why there aren't more women?
Yeah,
around the brain, around...
There's been so many different discussions. No matter who you speak to, everybody has an opinion on it. I mean, I heard an interesting study which was being done on how to get more Japanese, Chinese racing drivers, because obviously there's huge, vast amounts of money. There have been a lot of Japanese racing drivers over the years. We've had our first Chinese racing driver just now in Formula One. And actually, there's a study which is comparing females actually to the body prototype of, say, a Japanese racing driver, because they tend to be smaller, lighter. Formula One also is, you know, the drivers are slightly like jockeys. They're a lot shorter than you'd think they were. They have a weight limit. They have, you know, 3%, 2% fat in some cases. When you speak to a Mark Webber, who is a tall driver, David Coulthard, Jenson Button, the perfect example of that. These guys were so light, in fact, still are so light. It's incredible. But they've put their bodies into that position. So, you know, the smaller and lighter you are, the more benefit in many ways that there is. So, yeah, if it's anything, it's more difficult in the support races where the cars don't have power steering. That's where, a female might be more hampered than actually in Formula One.
And then because they're hampered there, they don't get the opportunity then to step up.
Progress.
Yeah. Really interesting. It'd be amazing to see.
Yeah.
Just because of, like I said, my ignorance to it, I didn't even know there was
Formula One. There's female drivers in the States racing at the highest level.
Yeah, I'm sure
and they're racing in the Indy 500 and things as well.
One, yeah.
You know, and the IndyCar Championship over there. There are quite a few.
How pally do you get with the drivers? These are some of the most famous sports. Do they call them athletes? Of course,
yes.
They're athletes. Don't you swear? Of course.
Yeah,
just because they're in a car.
Jenson Button did the London Marathon in 2 hours and 50 minutes or something like that. So, you know, they are pretty fit. They're not just slotting in and driving a car. Mm. Some races, they lose, 3-4 kilos through sweat, like a Singapore or something like that. So they've got to be pretty fit. I never set out to be friends with a racing driver, a rugby player, a tennis player. You know, if it happens, it's a bonus. Because it's nice when it happens. But particularly F1, we tend to be on the same flights. You go to the same restaurants, you mix in the same circles. It's not like when you cover rugby, you might see, a Saracens 3 times a year. You know, we're actually seeing the same people like 20 odd weekends of the year. So you naturally do get to know each other and share experiences, good and bad. And, if you're in Japan and there's a super typhoon, you're all sort of like, bunkered down together. So you do get to know them. Also, some of the drivers I started with, like I said before, that, in the support races. So Nico Hülkenberg, I've known since he was 17. Sergio Perez, exactly the same. I think Sergio Perez was 16. Lewis Hamilton, I knew him, a couple of times we had to share the hire car when we were both in the support races together. You do get to know people and then you'll drift apart. But there's always that level of respect because you always kind of know where you came from.
One of the coolest things, and I'm glad it came early because I got to listen to it in the book, was around you being invited to Michael Schumacher's
house. To the ranch, yeah.
to the ranch in Switzerland.
Ranch.
Oh, I'm gutted by his story.
Yeah.
I'm gutted. I don't know, it doesn't seem like there's going to be a good ending. And I don't want you to tell me, I don't want to know. I think when you speak about it and say that naturally people reached out to you for comment and opinion and you were just like, no, like I'm not, even as your role as a journalist who should or is be seen to be should to be given an opinion that you didn't. And again,
but I think that's a really important thing. It would have been opinion. I can't give an opinion on someone's medical state.
Mm.
That's not something which you can discuss. I can discuss Michael's career. I can discuss what Michael was like in my sort of dealings with him and getting to know him reasonably well. But at that time, after Michael's accident, I had no knowledge.
Mm.
Why would I go on television or radio and discuss it?
Mm.
A lot of people did, but it just didn't feel right at all to me.
Why have they not? Why has nothing come out? Like, why do you think? Because you've got one of
they're
the most
very
famous.
Private.
Yeah.
They're just private. And sometimes I think it's maybe angered the absolute diehard Michael Schumacher fans because they've invested in his career, even in his, you know, going to see him, merchandise, all the rest of it. So they would love to know, out of the goodness of their heart, you know, they would love to know. But I don't know. There's a whole thing in journalism generally. Is it public interest or the interest of the public? I think that's always a really important debate. But we don't own the right to someone's personal space. I think that a lot of people, particularly nowadays with social media and things, think that everybody owns the right to everyone's... There's no such thing as privacy anymore.
Mm.
But I'm really against that. Yeah. I think if you want to keep something private, absolutely keep something private. It's none of our business what happens in other people's lives unless they want to put it out there.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, sad. Gutted.
Really sad.
Yeah. What was it like, though, with him being at his... What's his gaff like, as you could imagine?
Do you know what was strange? I, like you, grew up watching Michael Schumacher dominating a sport that I loved. Then he retired, and I actually met him the first time in London. He was I was hosting an event, and he was coming on stage, and I was told I wasn't allowed to speak to him, and I thought that was strange. But that came from his agent at the time, or his manager, I should say. And then Michael came on stage, and I did speak to him, and he was absolutely lovely. Then he came out of retirement, and I couldn't believe my luck. I mean, I always think you shouldn't be starstruck when you're doing my job, because it's a job and I have to be professional and all the rest of it. But I was so excited and nervous that I was going to be able to interview Michael. And for whatever reason, we just quite early on, we did interviews and it got a lot of traction. You know, it was when, you know, social media and things was kicking off massively and people would see it. Like worldwide, the BBC had the rights to Formula One. It was going out in countries all over the world. And and it just took on a life of its own. So therefore, you know, sometimes I'd do an interview with him. And then the following week, we'd, you know, he'd want to address what he said to me. So therefore, I had to go back and do another interview with him. And he'd start off by saying something like, "Lee, I think I made you very famous last week." And I'd be like, "You did, Michael, you did." But there was a real respect there. And he knew that I had horses and that was my background. And I knew that he did as well. And he came up with this plan. His family, particularly his daughter, Gina Maria, is a very good equestrian. But in Western riding, so you think of like Yellowstone. It's not quite rodeo, but it is reining. That's what it's called. It's like dressage at a gallop. And I'd never done it before. So I got on this horse in West Sussex, had like 2 1-hour lessons, couldn't move. I was in absolute agony. And then I was like, okay, we'll take it to Switzerland. And the BBC were like, "What are you doing? You know, you have to do a risk assessment." So we're like, "What is this?" And I was like, "Well, it's literally dressage, a gallop, basically. It's a series of movements. Do you wear a hat? No. Do you wear any body protection? No. Is this your own horse? No.
Bareback riding.
They can basically, well, you have a saddle and stuff, but they were just like, they were, "This is never going to pass." And I was like, "I will take the hit on this if there needs to be one." And then sort of like the final question was like, "Do we need to insure Michael Schumacher?" I was like, "No, you don't." And yeah, then it was like, absolutely fine. So we went out there and it was fantastic. And he was an incredible host, but we were like the, you know, when you get the mascot that like comes and tries to take a penalty kick and like the crowd go wild because like, who are these people, you know, clowning around? That was essentially us. We were the halftime entertainment. So it was the European Championships. People like who really knew what they were doing. And then there was myself, Michael, and a few others. And it was amazing. And we did an interview and it went out on camp. It went out on BBC and all the rest of it. But it was great fun. And I did share a podium with Michael Schumacher, albeit I was wearing leather chaps and a Stetson at the time. So, you know, it was a bit random.
So cool, though. What's he like off the camera? But I mean, because great. We're talking about one of the greatest have ever done it. And you talk about the spotlight. Just around social media, imagine if it was now.
Oh my gosh.
He'd be one of the most famous people who wears a helmet. So you don't even see him.
Don't see
that.
That's the
much.
Thing. That, exactly. And that's why for social media has really opened up the world of, you know, motorsport, because these guys, you know, it's not like a golfer or a rugby player that when the final whistle goes or when they get to the 18th and the, you know, the ball drops in the hole, that you see the elation or disappointment on their face. You know, it's a faceless sport in many ways, which is why it has been opened up because of social media and other programs as well. But I always got on well with Michael. You had to be absolutely ready for anything that he would say, both on and off camera. But he had such a real warmth about him. I mean, it's in the book, but I went to film with him the week before the British Grand Prix at the Mercedes factory. And for some reason, I was to paint the Mercedes TriStar on the front of the Formula One car, but it was like with one of those paint guns and it was awful. I mean, literally just was like flying around out my hand. And I just had my nails done because I thought I should look, you know, smart on camera. And he grabbed my hand and he got the paint gun and he just sprayed across the top. He's like, do you want a manicure? And sprayed across. But I really don't think you're meant to get this sort of like car paint on your hands. It's probably quite, you know, lethal. And it was there for like 2 weeks. I was walking around like the Tin Man or something. I had the silver top of my hand.
You should have got it tattooed and said, Michael Schumacher did that. That's what I've got a picture of him through. I don't even know if he said it. Says it's signed. You know, you get the stamp on the back saying he signed it to Jim, as he would say. It didn't say love from Michael Schumacher. Let's just say it does. He signed it. So okay. I've got that at home. Keeping it for, and I've got Lionel Messi's boot as well. I'm sure. Oh. Yeah, it's probably not, but it says it is.
Where did you get these?
So I bought
bought them at the Barras in Glasgow. They're not legit.
No. So I got the Lionel Messi boot in Cyprus at a military event.
Okay.
For about 500 quid. No one wanted to buy it. I thought, that's Lionel Messi's boot. 500 quid. It's an investment. So what would that be worth now, do you reckon?
I don't know.
50 grand? No. It's not. He's not signed it, has he?
Well, you kind of want a certificate.
Got a certificate.
Oh, right.
I have. But does that mean it's legit or not? I remember Martin Johnson, when he won the World Cup in 2003, our team manager was signing all the shirts to come over sharing again.
Yeah.
So
you probably want to edit that better.
That's what's happened. No, we don't. We keep it raw. So anyone else that you really enjoy their company with? I know the answer to the question, but...
Yeah, I think I'm sort of mostly known for my interviews and the sort of fun relationship I had with Sebastian Vettel.
Mm.
But the great thing about Seb was I don't want to speak in the past tense about him because, you know, he's actually driving a car in a couple of weeks' time at Goodwood as well. But he is so clever, so intelligent. You could throw anything at him, which is why he did Question Time a couple of years ago. You know, a program that politicians shy away from. And he turned up in the UK and did it in his second language. Mm. You could put anything to Seb and he would have a really intelligent, witty, funny response. And I really appreciated that. And I don't actually think he ever got the respect he deserved when winning those four titles. He just used to really piss people off for some reason by winning. And it's almost like when he stopped winning, people are like, God, he's a nice guy. It's like, I don't really know what happens sometimes. And that's sort of like the psyche that people have when they watch sport. There's just some teams in rugby as well. There's some people that just really piss people off. And when Seb was winning, for whatever reason, he was one of those people. I think people still have that a little bit actually with Red Bull. You know, they just, for whatever reason, they just get a bit riled by Red Bull. What they don't seem to get like that with Mercedes, for example.
So this is a really superficial kind of question or statement. I get that feeling with Lewis Hamilton, not me personally, but when people, you talk about warming to, and maybe it's a time thing, I don't know, because we talk about Schumacher and everyone's Michael Schumacher, the greatest of all time. Am I right in saying that Lewis Hamilton has won the same?
Same number of championships.
And I feel that it doesn't feel the same energy towards him. Is that because he's still driving and it needs a bit of time to pass? Is it the moment in time? Is there something more deeper into that? That's just me. Or is it a British thing?
Well, I don't know. Do you feel that you could relate to Michael Schumacher?
No.
Exactly. Well, people think if you compare, for example, and I'm not talking in world championships, but if you compare a Jenson Button and a Lewis Hamilton, people felt that Jenson was the bloke you could walk into a pub and have a pint with, whereas Lewis, you couldn't do that with. He just operates in a very different way. But for me, I'm a huge Michael fan. I think he's, you know, the greatest driver. But Lewis Hamilton on track is incredible. He makes very, very few mistakes. How he conducts himself, the fact he's won championships for different teams as well, I think that always is a mark of a great. He puts himself in a position, even when he doesn't have a great car, that he sort of always fights and battles hard. And the fact that he's stuck around when I think a lot of people thought he would just go, OK, I'm not winning, thank you very much. He has such a desire to be successful. But I get why people don't feel they can relate to him. But he has been, he came into Formula One with such a huge sort of weight on his shoulders. He was like the next big thing. He hadn't even turned the wheel of a Formula One car and he was being heralded as a world champion. He grew up in the public eye. His life went from earning no money to earning tens of millions of pounds. But I think that the Lewis we have now is almost gone full circle to where he started in Formula One. He's as true to himself now as he was when he was, you know, 17, 18, 19, 20. And then when you're growing up, you know, people lose themselves a little bit. You know, the money takes over or they start hanging around with different friends or different people or all of a sudden, you know, you're going to, and getting invited to Met Galas and things like that. But I think recently, the more successful he's got, the more truer to himself or maybe more confident in himself he's become. Everything he does, his charitable work, his activism, you know, he's got the same friends that he's had since he was a kid with a sort of a few newbies along the way, who, you know, loyal friends. But it's not easy to make new friends, I wouldn't imagine. I mean, I don't know because I don't earn tens of millions of pounds. But I think you see it with footballers as well. Who do you trust? Who do you have alongside you? I like Lewis. I think he gets, does he get a bad press? I don't think so. But I think I understand why people maybe don't warm to him because he doesn't always put that out there. But I think as a sportsman and actually as a human being, he's you know, he's pretty up there.
It could be. And look, I don't look at any of the media, obviously, because I can't speak Spanish, broken French, German, whatever the language is. So maybe I keep saying superficial, but maybe it is being British. We don't embrace...
Applaud our own.
I know. We don't, do we?
We do to a certain point.
But then we bring them down.
And then we get like really pissed off that they're successful.
It's like a crash and burn. That's what we do. I saw that with David Beckham. Seen it with Wayne Rooney, can understand. He's got a checkered kind of history in the public eye.
People, you see it, but you know, Andy Murray's had a bit of it. Emma Raducanu's had a bit of it as well. You know, no one, and I always say this, no one picks up a tennis racket or drives a cart or picks up a rugby ball when they're a kid in the hope of being interviewed by someone like me. Mm. That's just an unfortunate part of what the job is when it comes to being an athlete in this day and age. And no one sets out when they take to a field or a racetrack or a tennis court to do badly. But if you're a sports person, if you're an athlete, you know, that's what's going to happen. You're going to lose more than you win on the whole. And yet some people seem to revel in that fact. And I think it's a lot of people with who have ignorance about what it is and what it takes to be a professional athlete.
Andy Murray's a great example. I love the bloke.
Yeah.
Even more since watching the doc. And fair play to him for opening that Prime Video, I think. I watched it maybe during the pandemic.
Yeah.
But I watched it and I loved it. And I thought, of course, this bloke is a great bloke. Most people are good people. But when you look at his personality on the court, Scottish, dour, but I have only heard like great things.
Yeah, I really like Andy. I like interviewing him. Again, he is someone who really fronts up. It doesn't matter if I'm on centre court and he's got a crowd around him. He doesn't feel the need to say the right thing or what would be perceived to be the right thing. I think he's refreshing in that respect. And he's actually as well been, you know, he's gone to his own beat. I think it's because of his mum, Judy. And then he had, you know, a female coach and all the rest. He's not done things that would be perceived as the norm. And I really like the fact that, you know, he's still battling hard with a hip that should
Why is he doing that, do you think?
Because he loves it. He absolutely loves it. Mm. Again, I don't know this. I speak to sports people all the time. But you must have seen it. When you know that there's a finite amount of time on your career. Why would you stop too early? He won at the weekend.
Yeah,
you know,
he's
gone out of Queens early, but I think he has had 16 matches in a row. That's where he's always going to fall down, just with the wear and tear. Because when I interviewed him when he went out of Wimbledon last year, the problem with him is it's not necessarily his hip, it's everything that becomes referred pain from that. So if you're saving there, then that knee goes or that shoulder goes, things that you didn't have. And you add in the fact that, you know, he is getting older. And this is what we see with Rafa. This is what we see with other athletes as well. But the fact that Andy has a metal hip, I mean, it defies belief.
Yeah, and with a metal hip, and I know players from rugby and other sports as well, where, yes, they're unbelievable what they can do now. But when I saw him going through that, I automatically wrote him off. I was like, he's done. And he won at the weekend. What was the...
He won a tournament at the weekend and he won it last year as well. Yeah. But what's so interesting is that the joy that he had, and then it was Father's Day and he sort of said, oh, well, I'm going to go home now and see my kids and blah, blah, blah. And he didn't know that his wife Kim had actually brought them to watch. Mm. And he looks up and he sees them in the crowd. And it's just, you know, there won't be too many days like that for Andy Murray going forward. I hate to say it, but that would be, again, the law of averages of sport and age and everything. So if he's enjoying it and still winning, why would he not keep going? He doesn't need the money. He's only doing it for love. If he's in pain and doing it and you don't need the money, you're doing it for love.
Exactly.
And I think that's really important. He had the same hip as Sean O'Brien has. Mm. And I know that they had dinner and spoke about it. And Andy Murray was like blown away that Sean was going to play in a contact sport with this hip. And Sean was blown away the fact that Andy was going to be like, you know, shuffling around sideways and trying to slide on clay and all the rest of it. But that's why Andy, you know, didn't play the French Open and saves himself for the grass court time. So fingers crossed. Because he went out of Queens, it means he won't have a seeding for Wimbledon, which is tricky. Because it could, you know, he could meet, you know, one of the top 10 in the first round. But, you know, I can't wait to see him there. I'll be on court and I cannot wait to see him.
When he won Wimbledon, I was just thinking about it as you were talking. I got goosebumps just thinking about it.
Yeah.
The emotion.
Yeah.
It was, and this, you talk about like celebrating what we have in Britain. Like, he's one of the greatest athletes we've ever had.
Yeah, absolutely.
And watching him win Wimbledon. Who did the interview?
It would have been Sue Barker.
Sue Barker.
Yeah.
It was Sue Barker. And the emotion, like you could... Yeah. And the thing is with tennis, right, it's all so close, isn't it? And I think about other sports. I talk about rugby, like the greatest sport on the planet, because I'm obviously want to talk up my sport.
Yeah.
But then I look at like what would be the most difficult sports from a pressure perspective, because you're in a team sport. It is much easier if you're having an off day, like you can hide a little bit. The greatest don't hide. I didn't hide. But when you look at these individual sports and I look at tennis.
Tennis blows my mind.
Yeah.
Tennis blows my mind when I'm on court and watching it. And when you see them almost having sort of a bit of a breakdown and screaming at their box. And they are so lost in that moment. It's like they've forgotten that there's an entire stadium of people on top of them, watching them. They forget that there are television cameras, the pressure that they are under. They just go into their own headspace. They go into their own world. And I'm fascinated by tennis players in particular, because that's probably the only sport I cover of individual athletes, but they fascinate me. They fascinate me in the interviews I do with them afterwards. You know, they have a team, but like, you know, we're talking physios and managers and people like that, coaches. In that moment on the court, it's them. And half the time it's them against themselves, because it is such a psychological game that, you know, you look at someone like Carlos Alcaraz, who's number one in the world. He will be, well, he is a Grand Slam champion, but he will go on to be a great. How great, we're not quite sure. He gets to the final of Roland Garros, the French Open, and he looks at Novak Djokovic standing over the other side of the net. And the guy is so stressed that he has full body cramps and can barely get through the match. Now, Djokovic goes on to become the most successful tennis player of all time. That is the fear that these guys, your Rafas, Rogers, Novaks, and at the, you know, earlier on, you know, a few years ago, Andy, would put into these guys just by their presence over a net. It's such a psychological sport. And a little bit like Drive to Survive, there's a tennis.
Fucking so good.
It's good. And what worries me is, whilst I'm sitting here chatting to you, is that the second part of the series Breakpoint drops today. And I just know that the producer came up to me at the Miami Grand Prix and went, Lee, you're going to be in the Nick Kyrgios one for Wimbledon. It's amazing. And I'm now sitting here thinking, it's today the 21st of June. It comes out today. So I really need
Does it?
Yeah. Because obviously last year I did a lot of interviews on court with Nick and they became, they got, again, a lot of traction worldwide. They went really well.
I really like him.
But yeah, it was just about giving him the space to be him. And
is he quite intimidating when he's, especially in tennis?
I've done a lot of interviews with him over the years, and some have been great, some haven't been great. But then he's been very, very open about his various struggles. So, you know, I don't know when he turns up to speak to me, but he's not wanting to speak to me. Let's be honest, he doesn't want to speak to me. But again, that's just part of the job, and I don't take any offence in that whatsoever. You know, there's plenty of other things he could be doing with his time, and likewise for me. But you know, I love my job, and I really hope that if he's got to spend 20 minutes with someone, I can make it quite a nice, fun, chatty 20 minutes. Sometimes it's been great, other times it's just, you know, almost been a waste of time. But that applies to a lot of different athletes, not Nick. And last year on court, for whatever reason, it just went well. I actually work quite hard on, like, there are ways to ask questions and there are ways to talk and present to people. And if you use Formula One as an example, 20 drivers, I'd probably ask half of them exactly the same question in a different way, because I know how their minds operate. I know what buttons I need to press to get a decent answer. Some need a little ego massage. If you try to give Max Verstappen an ego massage, he'd like throw it straight back at you, you know, twice the weight. He doesn't need any of that, you know. Some people do. So working with Nick throughout Wimbledon last year, a couple of interviews, I was like, okay. And then there was one match, it was really intense, and I just stood at the side. I didn't even go onto court, onto the grass, to start the interview. I let him just sit in his chair, and in my ear I was going, we need to start the interview, we need to start. He wasn't ready. He just wasn't ready. And then he looked over at me as if to say, all right, I thought you'd be hassling me. And I just was like, stood there, and he was like, I'm ready. And then he came on. And I think that just eased in. And then we did more and more interviews throughout the time. And then I did the big one before the final. And then obviously the final didn't work out well for him. But yeah, I just think it's about having the respect for the person who you're interviewing. There's so much trust in that moment in both ways. And some people will respond well to you and others will just absolutely go through the motions, and that's fine. But as long as I feel I've done the best I can in that situation, then I can sort of like go home and sleep a little bit easier.
That's why you're one of the best in the business.
Oh, thank
it's
you.
Unreal. Like listening to you talk about these people that you've interviewed is awesome. I'm going to double down on Breakpoint. So, and then I'm going to ask you a question. I'm going to put you on the spot. So when Nadal... It's the opening scene, maybe it's the trailer, when he is in, do you call it the tunnel?
I love this bit. This is one of my favourite things. I kind of watch it just for this. Psychs them out.
Yeah. So he's there in the the tennis thing, the couple of things. I'm getting excited here. So watching the Andy Murray doc, I didn't realise how tight they all were.
Yeah.
And then on Breakpoint, where Nadal is in the tunnel and he's like, wha-bam, wha-bam. He's like there, like... But like, so, as in working on his stroke and stuff like that, but aggressive.
So for people who are listening to this, this is like you're waiting in the tunnel and you're probably facing Nadal for the first time. And do you know what it makes the if there's Nadal and a rival, it makes the rival look like a kid off to school. They're sitting with their bags on their shoulders, like, you know, can't wait for this moment, trying to keep the anxiety. Nadal is sprinting past them, like, you know, backhand, forehand, sprints back past them. There's a great clip a few years ago from Wimbledon. As I say, it's a great clip, but he's so, like, pumped. He's leaping up and down nonstop, and he smashes his head off the roof. Literally before he goes out and plays at Wimbledon, he jumps so high, he's bouncing up and down like a grasshopper, smashes his head off the roof. He's, like, all dazed and confused. But I love Rafa. I do think Roger, Rafa, out of any sport I've ever worked in, they would be the two. I have never seen kindness that they show to the whole crew. So when you do these interviews in a little room at Wimbledon, you know, there'd be a sound guy, a camera guy, the guy who logs and organises everything. To this day, Rafa will go around and shake every single person's hand, give me a hug, all the rest of it. I see him once a year.
What a legend.
Like, I see him, like, I don't mean once a year, I see him like, you know, 14 days in a row once a year. And Roger was exactly the same. And one of my favourite ever moments was a few years ago at Wimbledon. And there was a tennis player, he was known as Dreddy Tennis, Dustin Brown. And he was seen a little bit as a sort of trick shot player, a little bit like Kyrgios when Nick first came on. But there was so much more, as there is with Nick, to this guy. And I happened to be interviewing Roger Federer in this little quiet room. And the thing that people don't realise is that I was actually, you know, I'm always doing these interviews, but I'm also watching centre court, because then I have to turn up on court and do the interview. So you're kind of really multitasking. And Roger obviously could see this, because I'd be asking Roger a question, then like glancing. And he said, and Roger said, are you doing this match? And afterwards I said, yeah, I am. And he went, this guy's really interesting. And he sat down with me in front of a TV monitor and watched about 5-10 minutes of the match. And he's like, in 3 shots, that ball's going to go here. And it did. And it was that moment I thought, this is like chess. He is so far ahead. Like, Roger Federer was so far ahead, as, you know, as every tennis player is. They're playing the shot that's in front of them, but they know what's happening. Like, when they put a serve down, they know what's coming next. And I find that really interesting. The fact that Roger sat with me and watched some of a match with me and talked me through it, to this, I mean, I'm getting goosebumps now. To this day, I cannot imagine how that will be surpassed. I hope it will, because it means it's going to be an even greater moment. But just the kindness, the courtesy, the respect that he showed me and the others in the room as well, it was just something really special.
That is so cool.
Just operate on a different level. Such a capacity for kindness. And I think you get that with the greats. It's not, some people are so exhausted and consumed about the sport or the job they do that, and I 100% get that, because sometimes it happens at me at work. Someone will come up to chat and I'm like, I'm just about to go on live and I don't have any room to converse. But people who are great find that, you know, they always have 10% yeah. extra.
People that are great, I think that, because everything
yeah.
must feel easier.
Yeah.
Slow emotion.
Exactly it.
You present.
Yeah. Dan Carter talked about that as well. You know, it's just having that extra space and capacity to see what's happening and to give yourself to others as well. And yeah.
I've underestimated tennis.
Oh, yeah.
But speaking out loud, I mean, it's not something that I'd think about it and I watch it and the doc, but it's not something that I've ever spoken about. But actually now we're speaking about it, I'm like, it is one of the hardest sports. I've seen it, like, I went to Roland Garros a few years ago, and the speed and the athleticism and the psychological pressure is the really interesting one. We're seeing that now with Emma Raducanu.
Yeah.
Like, playing out in the media, and we saw after she won the US Open, it was everywhere. And it was one of these things when we made a star of her in the UK, all over the newspapers. Like, young, athletic woman, like, what's going on here? It's all been about the Williams sisters for so many years. And then you look at her journey of changing coaches, like the injuries. She's popping up on the front of magazines. And you're thinking, in this day and age, with all the social media, and she's spoken about coming off social media and the pressures and stuff, you're just wondering if she can get back to that level. I mean, she's still young.
She's incredibly young. Mm. I think she's, what, 21 now or something.
Was there too much too early, do you think? Because you've worked in sport, you've seen it.
You can't control that. You can't. You know, she won the US Open from nowhere. She was a wild card. And the next thing you know, you're propelled into, you're a household name overnight, a household name. And you just break down her last few years. She's been through 5 coaches. That's not ideal. She had to go to court. There was a guy, some guy stalking her. She's had operations on both wrists and an ankle. I mean, that is an awful lot to put your body through. No one, again, is doing that for fun. Like, you know, she needs that. She needs to have those operations. I hope that you see it quite a lot with tennis players. You know, they sort of vanish off for a little while. Maybe they don't reach the potential that they showed, whether it be in juniors. For her, it was obviously US Open. And then, you know, they come back stronger because they just need to develop and grow. And I'm not talking about just, you know, with their own bodies. It's the mental game is colossal.
Mm.
Psychologically, can you imagine just being like running around at Murrayfield, a one-on-one situation?
No.
You know, it's like with people baying and screaming and shouting at you. And then what finishes and you go home and you've got to do it in 2 days again. Mm. Time.
I'd go into red mode. Aggression.
Just, you wouldn't be green. You would be full red.
I know. You just revert to type. And we've been very lucky. I say we. I'm putting myself in there. As a fan, I'm a fan now. Look at me. But with this generation of unbelievable players, is Federer the best? And it's so hard because it is the debate, isn't it? Because Novak Djokovic, I've heard he's quite divisive. Again, just looking at media stuff. And then Nadal.
You see, how do you measure greatness? Is it success? Like, you know, in which case, Novak has just become the most successful tennis player of all time. Now, I've interviewed him so many times. I've, you know, learned Serbian words to be able to say
it. What's he like?
Well, he's only ever been lovely to me.
Mm.
He's only ever... I can only judge someone on how they've been to me because otherwise it's, you know, it's not fair. But I've done some great interviews with him. He's always very kind. He, you know, he's takes time. In fact, I'll give you a story. A few years ago at Wimbledon, I wasn't meant to be doing it in centre court. Wasn't my fault. But I was on court one. The next thing I'm checking, I looked at my phone because I check the results all the time. And I was like, loads of missed calls. And whoever was meant to be doing centre court hadn't got there in time to do the interview. Now, it wasn't on court at that time. It was in our little cupboards off court that we used to use before the pandemic. And Novak had won and he was standing there. The floor manager, Owen Thomas, who I work with in Six Nations as well, was like, Novak, there's no reporter here to ask the questions. So he said, oh, I'll wait. And then he waited about 20 seconds. And in the end, because they needed to get the interview, Owen said, I'm going to ask you a question. Do you think you could talk for about a minute and a half? And Novak was like, yeah, sure, no problem. So Owen says, like, you know, he's kind of standing there all nervous. He was like, well done, Novak. You won. And Novak was like, yeah, I did. And then spoke literally minute and a half, bang. Next day, Novak turns up in the interview room with a photo of himself and put to my favourite reporter and gave it to this floor manager because he could see what Owen had been through, which was like a lifetime of stress in the space of about 45 seconds. And, you know, I think people wouldn't ever imagine that or see that. And Novak went out of his way to make sure that Owen felt that he'd done a good job, which I think is really, really lovely.
In the most unimportant time of the day for him as well.
Absolutely. And I just think that that is, you know, so, you know, people say that Novak is divisive. And but for me, the stories I've heard and how he's been with me is great. I'm a huge Rafa Nadal fan. I love the energy. I love, like, Roger is immaculate.
Never sweats.
You know, everything's white. Cardigan. Remember, he went through the cardigan era, you know,
Cool.
You know, just so classy, perfect. Rafa, an uncontrollable ball of energy. You see it before he serves. You see it how he is. You see it in the tunnel and the dock racing around. You see it in his interviews. I love that sort of... He's definitely not a flawed genius. He's just a genius in my eyes. But he also comes out with these big lines about, you know, he knows how great he is. Now, you don't get... Most of them never say that out loud. Roger knew it. Rafa knows it. Rafa would have won so much more had he not had the injuries that he's had. I mean,
his knee, I had a similar
his knees,
injury.
His feet, his hips. You know, when he stops, he is going to be in all sorts of bother. But I love, I think he's fantastic. And actually, when you looked at you know, the, when you basically get the Laver Cup and things and you get these like dream teams, I loved seeing how Roger and Rafa were together, how they interacted with each other, because they are so different and yet they're not. They're great at their game. The level of respect was colossal, and I loved seeing them together.
Because on the Andy Murray one, he talks about growing up and going to the same kind of academies as so are they mates off the court?
Roger and Rafa.
Well, Roger and Rafa, but like these players are, aren't they? Like they travel around and they've grown up together.
Yeah, it's a little bit like Formula One. It's a travelling circus. They would have played each other when they were, you know, juniors and worked their way up. Obviously, it depends on what age, because 1 or 2 years, you know, will put you into a different age bracket and then you're not. But Andy seems to be absolutely respected by all. You know, it doesn't matter if it's a Nick Kyrgios or a Roger or a Rafa or a Novak. These guys all absolutely love him. And I think that's a sort of real mark of a person.
I'm going to give him my top five.
Top five in tennis?
Top five in tennis. I didn't know if we were going to talk about tennis.
I wasn't even sure you knew five tennis players.
I do. Yeah, I didn't think I did either.
Well, I've just given you four.
You have. So this is based on nothing other than my mind now and emotion.
Okay.
So I love Andy Murray.
Okay.
Like, I'd love to get him on one day. Please, Andy Murray, come on. If he brings out a book, he's going to need listeners, isn't he? He's going to need people to
engage. Can I just say, I'm not here just because of my book. I'm just here for a friendly chat.
Well, this is what it's turned into. It's a conversation. It's not even an interview. It's a conversation. So I keep looking at the name Inside F1. I should know that, shouldn't I? Because...
yeah,
I'm doing the interview, conversation. So, number one, Andy Murray.
Okay.
Just because Andy Murray, Scottish.
Yeah, absolutely.
And Scottish. I love Rafael Nadal. And I kind of put it in there. He had a patella tendon injury. So did I. In a time in which it was tough to have that injury because there was no kind of cure. Owen Hargreaves, the footballer, had it. Mm-hmm. He had surgery. Rafa didn't. I didn't. And look at us. So, we're on a level.
But does he have the big Rafa show? No, he doesn't.
No, he doesn't.
So
no.
One up to you.
Yeah, no, yeah, I'll take that. Thank you. Does he follow you on social or not? No. I see he's not going to see this.
No.
So Andy Murray, I've gone Rafa too.
Yeah.
Federer, but he could be one, but I've gone Roger Federer. Love him. I don't know this bloke that well, but I've read bits of his book. Andre Agassi.
Yeah, great book. Great book.
Loose as a goose.
Okay. So... you're bringing him in for different reasons.
So I'm bringing him in.
He was actually a great tennis player as well.
Yeah, but they had them, like, did he play with the wood ones, the wood rackets?
No.
No, he didn't. No, that was before. No. That was Boris Becker, who we can't talk about. He seems wild.
You can talk about Boris.
Yeah, I'd have him, because I want him on because of the, like, his story about being in jail and stuff like that. That'd be pretty cool. But I'd have to go number five.
You've mentioned about six or seven.
Have I? Right, let me go five, and then you can give me three. So I'm going to go Andy Murray, Rafa Nadal.
Yeah.
Federer,
yeah,
Djokovic, I'm going to go,
yeah.
And then Andre Agassi. I didn't really watch Agassi play that much.
Agassi was great when I first started like watching tennis and things. That whole Agassi, Sampras,
Sampras as well, Pete Sampras.
Do you know the BBC office at Wimbledon is hilarious. Things happen in there. I've got a photo on my phone actually. We were doing this thing because quite often there's a World Cup or something around the corner, and the geniuses that be decided to come up with Coppa Uppi, which is the Keepy Uppy challenge. And we were trying to get everyone to do it. So I had to go to the practice courts and like, hi, Andy, would you mind doing some Keepy Uppies on camera? So this is like, you know, all of a sudden my job for the day. And we'd asked Rafa. And Rafa turned up in the office. And a picture on my phone is John McEnroe watching Rafa Nadal trying to do keepy uppies with a tennis ball, which is just like literally fired across the room, like obliterated. It's like a pinata's gone off. There's things flying from every direction. And Boris Becker in the room at the same time. And I just looked around. And this is like a room where there's like boxes of tonics, caramel wafers, and the bin needs to be emptied. It's like an absolute tip. Stationery cupboards exploded, all the rest of it. And I'm looking around thinking, Boris Becker, John McEnroe, Rafa Nadal doing keepy uppies. That's quite good.
I'm so jealous. I'm going to get into tennis.
Well, you sound like, I mean, you know a
more
minimum five players.
Well, give me your three.
Rafa.
Number one.
Yeah. Roger. See, I'm about to be a bit clouded because I've met these people and therefore they've created such an impression in my life. I don't want to leave out Andy, but then I do think, and Agassi, really.
Okay.
I think so. Because he was who I, again, so much of who you follow and support in sport is who was part of your childhood.
Mm.
So like a Michael Schumacher for me. It doesn't mean to say I'm not, you know, I know Alain Prost, and you know, never met Ayrton Senna, but I completely appreciated what they did. But for it's so much of what shapes you as a child is what you see.
Yeah,
then you nostalgia. Go back and you look back and all the rest of it when you develop, you know, a sort of interest in something. But for me, I think I just, I loved Agassi. Again, it was like, he turned up like this, just the hair and the headband, and it was just all a bit cool and unorthodox. You know, he wasn't really playing by the rules in terms of, yes, he was wearing white, but it's not quite what Wimbledon had seen for a while. So, yeah, he stood out for me.
I like Leighton Hewitt as well because he was Australian.
Yes, I've met him a few times. He's very nice.
Yeah, he's got a bit of Heath Ledger about him.
Yeah, he's good friends with Mark Webber.
Is he?
Yeah. Aussies.
You've got such a cool life. Do you feel like that or not?
Because when I talk
we were talking about the amount of travel, and this isn't about moaning.
No.
I struggle with travel, and it takes the joy out of some of the stuff that I do, because, and whether because I'm bad, I don't know whether it's a fly-in, I don't know what it is, but I struggle with the jet lag and all of these things. So I can't 100% enjoy some great opportunities that I have. If you're on the road as much as you are doing these amazing things, like, are you tired?
Well, I do suffer from insomnia, so I have been awake since 3 a.m., and that's in the UK. I think it's just an overhang of everything that happens. But
and you were nervous about coming on here as well.
I was really nervous.
Yeah, with all the people that you interview.
But I don't know. I mean, we do sort of all live our lives by this, that you only have a limited number of heartbeats, so use them wisely. That's how a lot of people in Formula One operate. So between the Six Nations matches, I went to Malaysia to give a one-hour talk in February. So I literally left a match, flew to Malaysia, spoke for an hour at a conference about how 5G and data has changed the world of Formula One, and then buzzed straight back and then did the next match. That's kind of how I operate. It's not particularly healthy, but I do try and put things in place to keep me healthy. But saying that, I am about to start from next week, every day until the 1st of August, every single day. And I am a little bit overwhelmed by the thought of that. They are great things. I'm presenting three F1 races and Wimbledon and the preview shows in the week up to Wimbledon. But it is a huge amount of time. Mm. And then I take August off, and then September, October, I'll do Rugby World Cup, and then I'll also present three Formula One races at the same time. Now, that is intense, but, you know, I do have to be slightly sensible. I had been asked to go to Singapore to do a one-hour talk again, and it was a Tuesday between the two World Cup matches, so I technically was free, but there comes a time where you just have to be slightly sensible. You will make yourself ill if you carry on like that. So yeah, I think I've got everything in place for the next 5 weeks. It is literally every day, but yeah, I just have to fingers crossed and get through it.
With your preparation,
yeah,
do you do it when you're traveling? Like, do you have any kind of hacks? You don't sleep on the plane? Because we were talking about not eat. You can fast on the plane and do all these things. But the amount of preparation that must go in, like anything from just getting the names right, not of the headlines, but of people that you might not have heard of before, like the data, the stats, and everything that comes with the stress of being on screen.
Yeah,
like, how does that all work?
F1 is actually quite easy because I'm part of it. And, you know, as long as I watch the races and get the notes and know what's happened, then that's fine. But I will have to write my script for the Friday morning programmes that I'm presenting at Silverstone on the Thursday whilst I'm at Wimbledon. That's the only time I have. Then I leave Wimbledon the Thursday night. Now, there's a roof, so it might go on till 10:30 at night. Then drive to Silverstone and probably be in for 7 a.m. and then do the programmes that day. That's my choice. That's fine. But I have, you know, it's two different channels. So I can't say to Channel 4, I'm sorry, I was really bad at my job today. I was really tired because I was working for the BBC yesterday. That doesn't fly. So I do a lot of prep. I have to do a lot of prep for Wimbledon, certainly, because I drop in on tennis, you know, once a year. Maybe I do sometimes Eastbourne or Queens. But yeah, The great thing is that when you love what you do, it doesn't really feel like work. People are paying an awful lot of money to go to these things, and I'm there getting paid to be there. So I have a responsibility to be good at my job. And quite simply, if I'm not good at my job, then I won't be there next year. I always have that in the back of my mind. So I do put pressure on myself. There's no doubt that I'm fortunate that most of the things I'm doing, certainly over the next 3 or 4 weeks, are UK based. So there shouldn't be any jet lag involved. Whereas when I'm doing a Formula One race, a lot of the drivers and people 3 days out will start to switch their time zone by maybe an hour or 2 hours. So you're not tired when you get there. I mean, it's not a particularly sociable way of living your life, but it does get you there much better prepared. I do work with a couple of people that can help me and advise me. You know, as soon as I get on a plane, I'm in the time zone of the place that I'm going to. So I don't really sleep anyway, but I wouldn't necessarily have screens on, even if I'm just lying there. I won't eat on a plane. I might take some of my own food, but I'm not a massive fan of eating on planes anyway. So I would just use that as a fast. And then when you get there, you know, I'd either go to the gym or depending on what time it is, you know, I'll just switch straight into to wherever I am. And if it means that I've not slept for 36 hours, so be it, because I will sleep eventually. But it's just looking after yourself and making sure that you have your supplements and everything that you need when you're away to get yourself through it.
That's where Athletic Greens comes into it for anyone that's travelling.
Or 4 or 5.
4 or 5.
4 or 5.
I love how we are flipping this round to George Cruz, my former teammate, and talking up his CBD, which you're involved in. So I'm happy to do that.
Yeah, exactly.
One thing that we've spoken about as well, I'm going to say there's a movement to empower women in sport, which is amazing. I've got a wife, I've got 2 girls at home, and I'm all for it. But I don't see it as a thing or ever have seen it as a thing, so I see it from a different point of view. Like, mm-hmm. It just is what it is. But we were talking about some of the best women in sport, like yourself, Gabby Logan, Jill Douglas, Laura Woods on TalkSport, Claire Boldin. I mean, we could go. There's so many great women that are doing stuff that a lot of men, most men, couldn't do. It's too stressful. Too stressful, too much detail, need to look great on camera and all these things that a lot of men can't do. Like, how do you feel like flying the flag in that space? Because these sports that we've talking about, and we've touched on women's sport, but the only where we've touched on it is a little bit in the tennis, and we kind of referenced it in Formula One.
Yeah.
But a male-dominated environment, and you're a woman that's fronting that, and there is this, is movement the right word, would you say? Do I say it more politely?
I don't know. It's interesting because I think the people that you've sort of named there in terms of Gabby, Claire, myself, Jill, we've been there for quite a while.
Hmm.
So, you know, we're all slightly different ages. And
you've seen the change.
I came in, you know, certainly after Gabby and Claire and Jill. But there is definitely more of a fixation about it now. But I was pleased I was there to begin with, because I've never had it in my mind that I was, you know, token bird.
Mm.
I've never had it in my mind that I was there to make up numbers. Maybe I was at the beginning. I don't know. But I didn't treat myself that way. And I think that's the huge, important difference, that I have never rested on my laurels. I've never been there and thought, do you know what? I'm female. Give me my chance. It's never entered my mind. I've never woken up on a morning and thought, do you know what? I want to be the best female to ask a question today. I want to be the best female to present a program today, because I would only be seeing 50% of the bigger picture. I want to be the best person to ask a question today. I want to be the best person to present a program today. Sometimes that's not going to work out, but that's the aim that I would always have. I wouldn't curtail my ambitions because of my gender. It doesn't even enter my mind. And it's a really interesting conversation that everyone's having at the moment. And, you know, I've said this before, but by all means, I think that everyone should be given opportunities, regardless of gender, ethnicity. Flood the grassroots of sport, flood every, you know, hobby, craft, whatever it is out there. Everyone should feel welcome. I feel very passionately about that. Everyone should feel welcome. But then there comes a point where we have a responsibility to be there because we're good at our jobs. And that's on us. That's on me. I'm not going to sit back at Wimbledon and think, God, you know, they need a girl at centre court. I want to be there because I'm at that given moment the best person for that job. I work that way. It's you know, built into my psyche. I treat myself that way. I work hard to make sure that I have that sort of, backlog of knowledge, as it were. And some days it will work out. And you come away from it and you're thinking, God, I did well today. It doesn't always happen, but it doesn't happen because I'm female, not male. That's the way it is. I can't change that. So I just want to be the best that I can be, regardless ethnicity, gender, all the rest of it.
Well, I didn't even know whether to ask that because it is quite topical.
It's very topical, but I think, you know, when you're at home watching television, there are so many channels that you can pick. There are so many different things that you can watch. The least that you can demand of the person who you've welcomed into your living room is that they are good at their job, regardless. So that is what I always have in the back of my mind. I want to be as good as I can be at my job.
Because I get asked, do I get nervous before I do things? I'm not putting myself nowhere near on your level, by the way. But I do, like even before this, before I do anything, I get nervous. And it's because I care about what I want to do. I've got other people that don't get nervous, and there could be reasons for that. Either that some they don't care. It's like they just do it, get paid, transactional, get paid. Doesn't matter if I do a good job. Some they'll be like sociopaths, so they don't get nervous. I get nervous because I care, because I'm conscious that not only is it an opportunity, but also a responsibility to deliver whatever it is, detail, information, charisma, to people that are paying. Because, I mean, there's so many different things that people can do now in terms of what they're watching. So to try and get their attention, especially on my sport, which is rugby, I feel a responsibility to make it as insightful, as give them as much knowledge in a way in which they can die. I'm not saying I do this, by the way, but that's in my mind that
but
I feel like
prepare,
I want to do.
Yeah, won't you? You'll do preparation to get to that. And there's a, you know, to go back to tennis, the great Arthur Ashe has a quote, and it's actually my screensaver. And to sort of paraphrase, it's one of the keys to success is self-confidence. One of the keys to self-confidence is preparation.
Mm.
And to me, that's it in a nutshell.
I used to be not a winger. I used to hide behind, I need to walk through it, or I would just turn up and see what happens. But now I'm getting more into a place where there is more pressure.
I thought you meant like an 11 or a 14. You were like around on the wing.
Should have been.
I never had you in that capacity.
You watched me play. One of the worst who've ever done it. Good fight.
I actually thought that you were a winger, as in, like, I thought.
I might have been the slowest professional rugby player. I say to professional rugby player as in Six Nations. I might have been the slowest Six Nations player.
But you weren't on the wing?
Ever. No. Definitely not on the wing.
No.
I would have loved to have been a winger. Centre. That's the best position centre, in rugby. Yeah. I'm going to Vegas in November.
Hangover 4.
The 18th. Hangover 4.
I'm going to wake up with a tiger in your room.
I would be very happy, and a tattoo on my face. I'm all over it. Never been to Vegas, but there's an F1 race there. And I saw it. It's like, you know what? If not now, then when?
It's a Saturday night Formula One race.
How cool.
It's absolutely
We don't know if it's going to be cool, but I imagine it's going to be unreal. So this is going to be the first one.
First Vegas.
Is this all because of this Drive to Survive doc that has
They've always wanted more US races. I mean, even 20 years ago, they were talking about doing one round Disney World or Disneyland. And, you know, Disney were nervous about it because of the risk of, you know, danger. It's a sport where, you know, bad accidents can happen, as we touched upon. So that doesn't really fit in with their, you know, Mickey Mouse and fun vibes. So Vegas is probably a little bit more Wild West.
But Disney have gone looser now.
But I do think it's probably, you know, right up Vegas's Strasse, so to speak. So it's going to be along the Strip.
Yeah,
you'll be there
wait.
Front and centre.
I will. Will you be there?
I'm not doing Vegas.
You're not?
No, not at the moment. We'll see how what happens in the championship. I'm doing Austin and Mexico. We split them. So there's just a massive back-to-back races at that time. I think it goes, for reasons unknown, the powers that be have made the calendar, Qatar, Vegas, Abu Dhabi. So, you know, they just popped to Vegas in between two Middle Eastern races. And they're back to back as well. So that will be the only thing, the only handbrake on the drivers going out on the Saturday night is the fact that they've got to get to Abu Dhabi for the final race of the year, like 24 hours later.
What do you call it? A travelling circus?
Travelling circus.
Like, that is exactly what it is. It is so fucking cool. Hey, like, as in the coolest thing on the planet to drive around in them cars. They're like jets.
Yeah.
With your helmet on, flying there, private jets.
Like, yeah, but you know what was really cool? And I've mentioned it before, but you know, when Mark Webber's last race, it's like, what does a driver do at the end of their career? What's he going to do? And Mark Webber took his helmet off and drove the track and like the wind blowing in his hair and all the rest of it. So I thought that was pretty cool.
Mm.
As your big farewell moment, like the last time you're going to be in a car.
Is that what he did?
Yeah. And they were furious that we're going to penalise him for it. He was like, bring it on.
Yeah.
What are they going to penalise him from? Yeah. He wasn't racing again.
I keep looking at the name. I don't know why it says Inside F1. Not that we're here necessarily to promote you, but I wanted to have you on even before the book came out.
Yeah, we discussed it beforehand, didn't we?
But for people that might want to get it, do you want to do a little...
Well, I think you said it all.
Inside F1 that you narrate.
Inside F1 is out now in paperback, hardback. You get lots of photos on that.
Jim, do you?
Yeah.
Right, I'll have to buy
it. Don't worry.
Yeah, I'll buy one.
But Jim, you listen to it. The foreword is by David Coulthard, narrated by myself. And it's not really about me. It's about the careers of 7 Formula One drivers, but told using all my old interviews and current interviews. But yeah, it's, you know, when I got a gun pulled out on me in Brazil, that was the weekend that Lewis Hamilton became champion and took a horse to Michael Schumacher. So all their careers are basically told through my random and amusing stories with them. But you'll learn an awful lot. If you like Formula One and you don't know the backstories to the drivers, this should fill in any of the blanks.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I spent one of my credits. You saw me press the button.
I know. I did.
Not wasted.
I did say I would have, given you a free copy.
No.
But you were adamant.
No. It's.
It was between Harry Potter and myself and I won out.
I've loved it. Thank you. I didn't think we were going to talk about as much tennis, but I'm happy we did.
Well, I'm excited. This is my life for the next few weeks. So I'm very excited about tennis.
Me too. Let's do it again.
We'll do it again. Thank you so much.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.